Morning, Council.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Can you please both make your appearances?
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Udovic, UDOVIC, appearing on behalf of the county board.
Michael Montecal, appearing for the county across the county.
All right, good morning. My understanding is that you folks, by agreement, have agreed to just do one argument each 30 minutes aside. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. By stipulation, that's fine with the court. Please proceed.
May it please the court. We're here today to determine, quite frankly, whether or not the Section 3-3 of the Hawaii County Charter is a valid exercise of the political will of the people of the county of Hawaii. Section 3-3 of the Hawaii County Code talks about the qualifications of persons who want to become council members of the county of Hawaii. And it requires that the person be a duly qualified elector of the county, which means they must be a registered voter of the county for at least 1 year, immediately preceding the election or appointment to the council. But it also requires that a person must have been a resident and registered to vote in the district from which the person is to be elected or appointed for at least 90 days immediately preceding the primary election or the appointment. So this particular section of the county code has a dual role. It has a durational residence requirement, but also a requirement that the person be a member of the electorate for a specific period of time. The facts in this particular case are stipulated that Ms. David, when she applied for a seat on the Hawaii County Council, had only been a registered voter in the district in which she sought election for 86 days prior to the election. And so she did not meet the requirement of the 90-day being a member of the electorate of the council, or pardon me, the district, council district, prior to the election. This suit was brought to challenge or to disqualify her as a candidate for the county council. The matter occurred kind of in two phases, one phase occurring with Judge Nakamura, who heard a motion for summary judgment brought by Ms. David with respect to issues of timeliness. Judge Nakamura dealt with that particular issue by looking at the Cronin case, which was decided in 2008 after the election for Congress with Mr. Abercrombie and Mr. Tatia, I believe it is. And in that particular case, the Supreme Court looked at the and said in order to determine whether or not a matter is timely, we look at the word shall and will, and they said when looking at the word shall, you have to look behind the reason behind the particular statute. And so Judge Nakamura, what he did was he looked behind the statute, determined that whether or not a hearing occurs, the shall there should be a little bit more expansive because the purpose of the hearing was to determine whether or not a qualified person was going to be appearing on the ballot in the county of Hawaii.
Isn't another clear purpose of the statute to establish deadlines so that the dispute would be resolved before the election?
I wouldn't disagree with that at all, Your Honor, and I think the dispute was handled before the election in this particular case.
Right, but under your interpretation, the court could simply have not decided the issue until after the election. What would impose a deadline if the language is directory?
Well, I think that if the language is directory, I think the deadline would be imposed upon the court. The courts themselves understand the need to have this particular issue decided prior to the election. So I think some of it is self-motivated by the judges themselves. I don't think, in all honesty, they need to have an awful lot of direction from the statute in this particular case. Here we're talking about a very short period of time. It wasn't a matter of months or weeks. It was days, perhaps. If it was filed improperly, it was just days before it would have been passed. And it was a hearing occurred on September 9th, I believe it was, and the ruling occurred immediately thereafter. And Ms. David did, in fact, appear on the ballot. So she did appear on the ballot. And so that issue may well even be moot in this particular case because of the fact that she appeared on the ballot. And so the issue is kind of decided. But the ultimate issue really boils down to whether or not Judge Hara's ruling on the second portion of this particular matter was an appropriate exercise.
But isn't there still an argument that the time limitations are significant from the candidate's standpoint because until the court decides the issue, there's a cloud over whether or not the person is going to ultimately be qualified? In other words, isn't it a rational explanation of the legislature's setting of deadlines that the legislature wanted to decide, the courts decide this issue soon enough so that any potential cloud on or residual negative inference or effect on the candidate would be removed in sufficient time for the candidate to go before the public and say, hey, I've been established by the courts to be a qualified candidate.
I can't disagree with that analysis, but I think in this particular case what happened was the decision was done, you know, almost immediately. It wasn't there wasn't any lengthy period of time or any reason for them, someone to go to the, for example, the Supreme Court to get rid of mandates, and you've got to hear this particular case because it was heard, you know, in particular fashion, you know, very, very quickly in this particular instance. So not only is it the issue of the timeliness that appears in the statutes, but the manner in which the case itself was conducted, quite frankly. And, you know, but the Supreme Court also looked at the reasons behind, you know, the decision. And so, you know, Judge Nakamura ruled that we have to decide whether or not this person is a qualified candidate. And if we were to cut this off and a person who's an unqualified candidate would have appeared on the ballot, then we would even be in worse trouble than we would otherwise if we hadn't heard this, even if there was a time for this issue.
Whose obligation was it to read the statute and figure out what the deadlines are? Even if it's the rectory, it doesn't give the court carte blanche to simply ignore the statute, does it?
I don't think it does, but I think what it does in terms of the Cronin case really tells the court that you have to look at the whole purpose behind the statute. You look at the legislative history, you look at the what the statute says, what the purpose of the statute is, and I think that's what they did. They looked at the purpose of the statute to determine whether or not a qualified candidate was going to appear on the ballot. And so Judge Nakamura said that we're going to have a hearing in this particular case so that it's not just a default. Somebody wins by default, they get on the ballot if they're not a qualified candidate. Here we're talking about a 4-day lapse in time when they're a registered voter. But let's say, for example, someone was a felon and they're not permitted to be on the ballot. I mean, are we going to permit a felon to be on the ballot because a time frame was limited by a short period of time? And I don't think that's where we went. He said we've got to decide this to make sure that the ballots are proper.
Is there any other vehicle besides 12-8 to do rule on whether a party on the ballot is legitimate?
I'm not aware of any. I wish there were. I mean, you know, perhaps you could make a constitutional challenge somehow. But I don't know how that would be. I, for the life of me, I can't think of anything other than 12-8, Your Honor.
So, in other words, you think if you miss disqualifying a candidate prior to the election, once the election is held and the person is elected, end of story.
Well, they could be disqualified if they're not a proper candidate. I mean, I think there was a case just recently on Lanai where a Maui council member was. Had moved his residence from Lanai perhaps to Maui, and so they said, I'm sorry, but you're not qualified to be a member of the of the council because you no longer live in Lanai. So I think they look at a variety of factors, not just the statute itself, but you know, the broad range of what the issues could be.
Now, one of the issues that I saw is that the where things started to go wrong apparently was from the summons and the complaint. A regular summons was issued, whereas a statute requires the issuance of an expedited summons.
Correct.
Who's responsible for issuance of the summons?
Probably the person who filed the lawsuit. I mean, I'd be standing here and being disingenuous otherwise. I don't know if when they had the summons issued, whether they thought about it or what. But you know, the regular summons was in fact issued, and it wasn't an expedited summons, which the statute requires. I agree. But I still think that you still have to look at whether or not a person is a qualified candidate. And so that's really where the essence of the case is. Is a person a qualified candidate? And that's why we had the hearing to determine whether or not they met the qualifications. And that's why Judge Nakamura permitted to go forward. And we disagree with the ruling of Judge Hara in this particular case, where he says that it was an undue burden on her as a candidate. And I think the proper standard is, since it's not a fundamental right, the right to be a candidate is not a fundamental right, that the right itself has to be looked at very carefully. And then the court has to determine that there's no rational basis, quite frankly, for the...
Before you go to that, one more question on the discretionary thing. Assuming we agree with you that the language of the statute shall is directory, Is there any limitation on that? In other words, once we decide it's directory, then whatever the court says goes, or is there some point in which, even if it's directory, the court violated the provisions of the statute?
Perhaps, but this is kind of a relatively new area of the law. I mean, there's very little reported case law on the Cronin case, quite frankly, and this is one of the areas that the Supreme Court decided that it was appropriate for the judges to exercise their discretion. And at some point in time, it may become an abuse of discretion, but I think that would be something which has to be resolved, since this is a judicially created method of analysis, that it's going to have to be created either by additional legislation or by additional court cases, unfortunately.
Counsel, but in the Cronin case itself, wasn't the distinction between 430 and 432 and that the true purpose was the end of the business day on the 20th day, and isn't that really different?
Perhaps it is, but the analysis, they didn't say that the analysis is limited to time frames or to specific,
But it did say that the 20th day was mandatory. It was the 430 versus
correct.
432
correct.
Was directory, right?
Correct. No, I agree. I agree. It did say the 20th day, and they said just because the clerk's office closes at 430 doesn't mean it can't be filed, I presume. You know, that's where the federal courts are a little bit different. You can file things at 11:59 at night, in a little box outside,
For better or worse.
That's just the way they do business to make sure that it can be done under the electronic filing may satisfy that problem now, but we perhaps didn't have that at the time.
So consistent with that, wouldn't there be an ultimate drop date deadline under the statute by which the court had to make a decision?
There might be, but it still has to determine whether or not the candidate is qualified. And if the candidate doesn't meet the qualification, here, like I said, we're just talking about a member of the electorate for a specific period of time. But it could have been that, like I said, they were a convicted felon.
Your analysis is that decision could have been made the day before the election.
Perhaps, but with my knowledge of the hard work that the judiciary does, I can't imagine anybody, prolonging that decision, in that fashion. I mean, nobody wants political pressure brought on them, especially members of the judiciary. I mean, hopefully you're immune from that, but I can't say that you would be in that situation, but I cannot imagine that, it would be done any other way. I don't have a better answer, in all honesty. I think it is what it is, and, we have to deal with the facts of this case as they are and not make up things, quite frankly. But the real thrust of the issue, I think, is whether or not the person qualifies under 3-3 to be a candidate, for the position of the council member. And I thought a lot about this and wondered what is the real basis or how can we really look at Section 3-3 and determine whether or not being a member of the electorate of the county has any significant interest in this. What is possibly could be a rational basis for that? And I think there are a couple of things, that you have to look at really the durational residence requirements, are historically have been upheld. The Constitution itself in Article 1 deals with a 7-year and a 9-year residence requirement for members of Congress. The president has to have been a member for 14 years. 1-year residence requirements have been upheld as being valid. As a matter of fact, the state of New Jersey, which dealt with that Robertson case that Mr. Matsukawa cited the court to, the federal district court that made that decision in the Roberts case, just recently decided that a 1-year residence requirement to become a member of the state senate was a valid exercise of the authority of the state of New Jersey. And that's in a case of Carl Lewis case, Lewis versus Guadagno. I have the citation here somewhere. But it was just a recent decision where they even, backtracked from their position. But I think really looking at whether or not there's a rational basis, there's a couple of things we can look at.
Before you get there, what's your argument as to why we should evaluate it as a rational basis? In other words, why not strict scrutiny, balancing tests? What's the justification for using a rational basis test?
Because none of the court decisions that have come forth have said that the right to be a candidate is a fundamental right. The right to vote is a fundamental right, but not the right to be a candidate. The right to travel is a fundamental right, but not the right to be a candidate. And so consequently, if the right to be a candidate is not a fundamental right, then the test that you utilize, throughout looking at all of the case law in this area is the rational basis test. And if we can find that there's a rational basis, then that should be upheld, because we don't want to lightly, say that provisions of the Constitution of the County of Hawaii, so to speak, the county charter, is invalid. We should try to find ways to find that they are valid, and if there's no violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution, then that should be a rational basis, should be the test.
Is that what this case was about, the United States Constitution?
Well, I think that it, kinda. I mean, you know, because when you look at
Was it identified below? Was it argued specifically?
No, I think it was argued peripherally. I think you're correct. It was argued peripherally.
What was the constitutional basis alleged specifically? Is this an equal protection case? Is that what was argued?
Yes.
It was argued as an equal protection
case.
Yes.
And that's why Judge, in the ultimate order, Judge Hara made the finding that that the requirement that a person be an elector in the particular district for 90 days, and he used specifically, he said, regardless whether the strict scrutiny test is utilized or the rational basis test, it's an undue burden. That's what he found. But undue burden is not the standard by which we determine whether or not these matters should proceed forward. It's the rational basis test.
But the U.S. Supreme Court in Anderson Calabresi and in Burdick, for instance, that haven't they utilized the balancing test?
In some fashion, but not when it comes to candidates' rights, perhaps voters' rights and things, but not candidates. The right to candidacy. And so, but when you look at, is there a rational basis? And that's kind of where I'm going. And you take a look at some of the decisions by the Hawaii Supreme Court, as a matter of fact, or the three-judge panel which decided the recent election case about whether or not the permanent resident excludes military and that kind of thing. And they really kind of look to, what are we looking at? We're looking at someone who has some permanence in the state of Hawaii. So from that standpoint, permanent resident is defined as someone who has some ties, real specific ties to the community. And they
there's already a residency requirement. We're talking about the voter registration requirement.
So I understand.
What's the rational basis for the voter registration requirement if there is already a residency requirement for to become a candidate?
Yeah, there's a 90-day residence requirement as well as the electorate requirement to be a member of the electorate for 90 days. And I think some of that boils down to or goes back to the fact that this is perhaps a little bit different in terms of a nonpartisan election. And the purpose behind the residence requirements, even perhaps the electorate requirement in this particular situation, is that the candidates get to know the district as well as the district getting to know who the candidates are. And so I think that the purpose of the county charter is to ensure that people who are going to become members of the county council from a particular district have a real connection to the populace. And if they're not registered voters in that particular district, then the county charter itself says that they don't have that connection that's necessary for a nonpartisan election.
So the rational basis is that being a registered voter signifies some connection to the population that the candidate's going to represent.
I would say so. And the connection, which is more than just being a resident. And the whole point is, and it was argued in the at the hearing in this particular matter, that we don't want people coming in cherry-picking, they talk about. Coming into a district and cherry-picking, picking a district which is easy. But if you look at Section 3-3 as well, it also says that people, if there's a vacancy in the office, they require that the people be not only a resident for 90 days, but also be a member of the electorate for 90 days. And so that same qualification applies to both the new candidates for a particular office as well as someone who's an appointed candidate. And I think if you look at that as the basis, that's the basis. You want to make sure that people who come in to be a member of the county council have that connection necessarily with the particular district. And there's no distinction here. They don't say that we have one distinction for people who are being appointed as council members, and we have one distinction for people who are running for election. We say that they're required to be residents for 90 days as well as being a member of the electorate for 90 days. And I think that nonpartisan elections, the importance of that from a nonpartisan standpoint is probably in this fashion. In a nonpartisan election, you don't have the benefit of having a political party behind you saying this is our philosophy. And so our candidate, if someone's a candidate of a particular political philosophy or political party, that they're going to espouse this particular philosophy. The candidates have to get to know the people in their district, and the district has to get to know them. And so they have a real, real requirement to do that. And if we have people moving in and out all the time, hoping to find an easy place to pick to become a member of the council, or trying to get an appointment if someone leaves the council, why would we want to make it different for someone who's appointed to be a council member and someone who's running for council? And so I think that's kind of where the distinction is. And I think that's a real rational basis, quite frankly, for this matter.
Is there any legislative history in terms of the charter amendment that imposed this requirement as to what the reason or purpose or background of that charter amendment was?
No, the charter amendment occurred, as I understand, in 1990 when they moved from at-large districts to individual districts. And so when that was made, the charter was made, and it moved to nonpartisan elections, I think we can infer that their intent was to ensure that people who were really connected to a district become a council member for the particular district. That's the only alternative or solution that I have for that particular issue.
Do you know, there's indication that other counties don't have that requirement. Do you know nationwide whether registration requirement is an issue to residency?
I would have to say, quite frankly, having an additional qualification of being a member of an electorate for a specific period of time is an unusual qualification. It's not a run-of-the-mill qualification, quite frankly. And so that's why when we talk about durational residence requirements, we're not really talking about this particular aspect of it. The durational residence requirement is being a resident for 90 days. And then the additional requirement of being a member of the electorate is kind of a different, it is a hybrid, I would agree. And I don't think it's very, it's not utilized very often. But I think that the rational basis, once again, like I've said, is specifically with respect to the voters getting to know the candidates, the candidate getting to know the voters. Because there's an awful lot of case law which talks about the need or the ability of making sure that we have valid elections, we don't have frivolous candidates, we don't have lengthy ballots that are confusing and that kind of thing. And I think all of those things supply, quite frankly, a rational basis, for the matter at hand. I don't have anything else to offer the court. If you have any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them if I possibly can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'd like to respond to some of the questions that were already raised, since it's timely. As to the point as to if the court didn't get to rule in a timely manner and the person was on the ballot, what happens if the person gets elected, and is there some estoppel concept or res judicata that the person is qualified? I think the answer goes back to the charter itself. It has a provision that says the office is deemed vacant if certain conditions are determined after the election or at the time of the election. For example, the person is no longer, the expression here is qualified elector of the district, or is no longer a resident. So there is a mechanism to catch something that wasn't caught in the expedited court process. And I think the court's inquiry is a good one in terms of the history. I think if you really look at this provision, just two sentences, I dwelt with it for the last week. How come this came to be a problem? And I think you can see that when the county went to nonpartisan elections, prior to 2000, when the county went to nonpartisan elections, the county was dealing with partisan elections. You had people ran for council as a Democrat or a Republican. So to a large degree, the party took care of these issues. Who's a resident? Who's a qualified elector, etc. So it was an in-house mechanism that worked. When the county went to a nonpartisan system then, there was no party in charge. So 12-8, however, was left unamended because 12-8 just dealt with elections as a whole, statewide. The county charter in 2000 said, we will follow state election law insofar as applicable. So, which parts do you pick? it was somewhat ambiguous. And then when you look at what happened to Section 3.3, there's more ambiguity. In the first sentence, you have to be a qualified elector. And what does that mean? Some courts question, well, you're a citizen, you're over 18, and you live there. It doesn't say you need to register or actually vote. The next sentence says you have to be a resident. And I think most courts are comfortable with that term. The Supreme Court just ruled on the Maui case, Kahoʻolohalo case about what is a resident, blah, blah, blah. Then the third phrase that appears in Section 3.3 used to be resident voter. Then that was changed to registered voter. But it doesn't say registered voter where. It just says of the district. So does it mean you have to register in a specific precinct? Or is it sufficient to be a voter who happens to reside in that district? And to make the ambiguity even greater, when you look at 13F, which is the section not amended in 1990, left alone, and it contains the language on vacancy, which I alluded to earlier, that uses the expression qualified elector of the district if the person had to run from the district at the date of his election. There's no 90-day rule or 30-day rule. So what is the eligibility standard that was intended given these series of ambiguity? I read the Stock Rail case in which this court, had to deal with a charter amendment in Oahu where the voters were told we're changing the voter base from numbers of votes cast to registered voters for a petition. And they changed one section of the charter, left the other section alone. This is the same thing that happened here. The record shows that the Charter Commission told the voters the change is single member district and that you have to live in the district.
Okay, so you explain, so how are you interpreting a person must be a registered voter of the district from which the person is to be elected?
At first, at the trial level, I think the pleading showed that I argued in the alternative that what it meant was either or, because either standard was a measurement of the person's residence in the district. And so if it's an either or.
Either or what? What are the two alternatives?
Either a resident of the district or a registered voter registered at a specific precinct in that district.
Right. Why isn't the latter the most natural and obvious interpretation of the provision? There's already a requirement that you be a resident. Isn't and indicate an additional requirement? And doesn't that make sense that you're being required to be both a resident and a registered voter in the district that you're running for?
Well, I would agree, but you know, like the word shall, and has been interpreted as being or. And in this particular case with the voters, this wasn't the county council passing this. The voters were told persons running for the district must live in the district. That's what they voted for. So what was intended? It's hard to interpret the voters' intent other than what was on the ballot. And there's an exhibit in the file where the actual ballot has those words written right on the option, you know, yes or no. Other than that, I think the issue of my cross appeal, I think the court has exhausted the discussion, but I'd like to emphasize that there was the Nishimura Williams case that just was published by this court. In that case, the court followed the process. They worked at a timely disposition of the case. And I think that was the whole idea behind the legislature in enacting 12A, yes. Does the court hold some discretion? Because if I remember right, in the Kauai case, the candidate in question was not on island. He was in Seattle at the time. And the circuit court judge gave some allowance to wait, I think, until the person came back. But they're still working within the 5 days. And then they had the summary hearing and the ruling came out. So if you don't follow the statutory guidance as something that's mandatory, then that was my fear below. When will this case ever get heard? So the court will look at the pleadings. We filed a motion for summary judgment to bring it to the court's attention to get a timely disposition.
Okay, so give me the time sequence then. So is the summary judgment motion when you brought this issue to the court's attention? Or was there some prior pleading in which the court was told, hey, the statute says there are these deadlines, you're not following the deadlines?
There were two. First, there was a separate complaint, separate action that preceded this one that was filed as a DAC action in the Kona division of the circuit court to resolve the ballot question. Subsequent to that, the candidate's papers were received. So it sort of mooted out that Kona case.
That's what resulted in the Supreme Court issuing a writ of mandate, is that right?
It was right after that. There was still some resistance about accepting the application form. So there was a civil case in Kona. Then the county then initiated the clerk's objection in a separate case on August 2nd. And in the cross appeal, we argue maybe it was untimely, when was the trigger pulled? That I think that the court can handle with the pleadings. But then on August 2nd, the complaint was filed. We accepted service on the 5th, I believe, and then on the 10th, filed a motion for summary judgment to bring the matter to the court's attention.
Right, and did the court expedite the proceedings in connection? So August 5th is when you're saying that the court was notified in writing, hey, there's a statute that says these are the deadlines.
Oh, no. It wasn't until the motion for summary judgment was filed that the court was advised.
Wait,
I think
that was
August 10th.
August 10th.
Or thereabout. I think it was the 10th of August.
And the court ultimately entered its decision when?
September 7th. We were having a hard time getting a hearing and a judge. And then the judge Harden ruled 2 days thereafter.
Now, you indicate in, and I'm looking at the statute, but you have a footnote 19 in
yes,
your
I know
opening
which one you're
brief
looking at.
In which you acknowledge that under the statute, the clerk could have waited until 30 days before the election to actually file the complaint or file the objection or initiate the process. And if they had done that, then the actual deadline under the statutory terms would have been September 10th.
That's correct.
So
that's where the key is. When he kind of just filed a complaint on the 30th day before the primary, there's a trigger, right? There's an objection, and then 7 working days to file.
Right, but
so he would have to time it. In an ideal world, he could have waited to file his objection on the 29th and then file his complaint on the 30th, I believe.
So that would have been permissible under the statute?
If those were the facts, yes.
Right. Now, isn't it consistent with Cronin, which says that the ultimate intent of the legislature in Cronin was 20 days before? So looking at the statute, isn't the mandatory drop-dead date based upon the statute, September 10th, which is after the decision in this case?
I think the ultimate drop-dead date would have been, yes, the 10th of September, and the decision here was made on the 9th. And I think that's what motivated Judge Nakamura to make sure this case got heard by somebody by the 9th, which happened. But the outside date.
So why shouldn't we adopt that as a mandatory, in other words, if you read the statute in a mandatory fashion, why shouldn't we interpret the statute consistent with the Cronin case as that's the mandatory deadline that the legislature intended, and that's the mandatory date by which the court has to decide this issue?
I think because the facts to a large degree drive this thing, because there are deadlines up front, not just at the end. So the upfront deadlines are the triggering deadlines, which I think is a subset of this larger scheme. Yes, in a perfect world, depending on the timing of the facts, the outside date is September 10th. But if someone elects, a political party files a complaint, we can't control that. Or if someone else files a complaint, you can't control that. Then the time period is moved forward. And you have to follow those deadlines. So it's mandatory in that sense. So that's what I said in my footnote. In an ideal world, if things had worked out factually, it could have been the 10th. But I think a proper reading would be, this is an election case. Everything is time sensitive. So the key fact is not the outside date, but the triggering date. When does this all start? Because once we know the start date, everything else falls into place, which is what happened in the Kawai Nishimura case. I have no more arguments. If the court has any questions,
right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll take this case under advisement.